Well, good evening. Good to see you. Greetings from Ballymena Baptist Church, back to Hamilton Road. Had a good time this morning. Thank you for your prayers. It was their harvest service this morning. It was great to have the opportunity to speak there. And it's interesting how the two themes between this morning and tonight overlap, as we'll see as we get to the end of our service tonight. Now, we're moving back to Ecclesiastes. Trust that you're finding your way through that in terms of where it is in the Bible. We've made it easy tonight. It's page 669, if you're not quite sure where it is. And rather than reading our way through this passage, it's quite a long passage we're looking at tonight. We're going to look at it as we work our way through together. So it's very helpful for me if you have a Bible in front of you this evening as we look at a passage which takes us from chapter 1 into chapter 2. Now these pyramids on the screen behind me this evening were one of the great wonders of the ancient world. And some of you probably visited these pyramids. Just hands up if you've seen anybody been to these pyramids and just outside Egypt. There are 2, 3, 4 of you have been there. I've not seen them myself, but I read some staggering statistics about these pyramids this week as I was preparing the scene. These are just outside Cairo. Massive monuments, memorials to a great civilization. They probably would have been known to King Solomon, whom we're fairly accurate to say was the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes. And this pyramid that's in the middle here is a staggering 500 feet tall. And it contains somewhere in the region of 2.3 million blocks of stone. That's just the middle pyramid on its own. And none of those blocks of stone are less than 2.5 tons each. Staggering construction. It's been calculated, I don't know who makes these calculations, it often puzzles me, but somebody has calculated that if you took all of the stones out of these three pyramids and you exported them all to France, you could actually build a wall all the way around the perimeter of France. I don't know how you work these kind of things out. But the wall would be 10 foot high and 1 foot thick. That gives you an idea of just how many stones are in these amazing pyramids. And they continue to stand today. And some of you have visited them, and I'm sure others of you who are here probably will visit them over the course of your life. But they stand as a monument to a great civilization in the past. They were a desperate attempt by some of the Egyptian kings to cope with death. And today they're a sobering reminder to us that however long we live, there is one thing certain in life, and that is that one day we will all die. Now, these pyramids in some way or another act out the message of the book of Ecclesiastes that we've begun to look at together on these Sunday evenings, that life without God is meaningless. And some of these pharaohs were so obsessed with life after death that they spent all of their lives planning to build one of these pyramids for the point at which they died. So all of their life was committed to the point at which they died. And it's this question of meaning and purpose that the book of Ecclesiastes starts to open up. Some people are very surprised to discover that this kind of material is actually in the Bible in the first place. Someone said to me on the way into church tonight, do we have to look at another meaningless passage in the book of Ecclesiastes? Well, I know they were pulling my leg, but it does have that kind of feel to it. You think, what's this doing in the Bible? A book in which God is hardly mentioned, and yet its purpose is designed by God to catch our attention, to stop us in our tracks, as we discovered last week, to see at the end of the day that if you live life without reference to God, you will find that it is empty and it is purposeless and it is meaningless, no matter how passing some of the things may be in this life. And it struck me as I was looking at these pyramids, you know, that in some way or another, all of us are actually involved in building little pyramids. We're all involved in building little pyramids, and they may consist of all kinds of things in our lives, but things that we want to be remembered for, or things that we want to achieve in this life. And it seems to me that as we go through life, we kind of leave a series of little pyramids behind us, or perhaps we're planning to build a series of little pyramids. Successes that we want to go for in life, which are important to us. Perhaps our careers. Perhaps for some of us it's leisure, perhaps for some of us it's football, perhaps for some of us it's retirement, perhaps for some of us it's careers, perhaps for some of us it's family, perhaps for some of us it's for relationships, because you see, all of us here tonight are building for something. And the book of Ecclesiastes in some ways exposes what it is you and I are building our lives for. What's it all about? What is the meaning and purpose of life at the end of the day? And that's why some of these passages in the early sections of Ecclesiastes are hard going. I went into Johnny on Thursday afternoon. I said to him, boy, this is tough stuff. I'm so depressed. And he actually did the same to me a week previously. He came into my office when he was looking at the first passage on the Thursday afternoon. He said, it's so depressing, this stuff. But actually it exposes the reality of life without God. And life without God is depressing, because there's no message of hope. And so tonight we come to the subject of the search for satisfaction. Now, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you, and certainly not going to sing any songs tonight, but there are a few songs which probably come to your mind when you think of that theme this evening. There's the Beatles, who tried to, in some way, speak the words of what people were saying at their particular stage of life. And here's this famous song: I can't get no satisfaction, because I try and I try and I try and I try and I can't get no satisfaction. They were singing what so many people were feeling back in their generation. More recently, the famous rock group U2. Here are some words from one of their songs. I have climbed the highest mountain. I have run through the fields only to be with you. I have run, I have crawled, I have scaled the city walls only to be with you. But still haven't found what I'm looking for. I see our popular culture pulses that message into our world, because that is the search that people are on. What they're looking for isn't working. And people are singing it in the songs that you and I listen to. This search for satisfaction. Here's how someone has attempted to describe that sort of circle of life, which perhaps some of us can identify with this evening. We set our goals in life. We achieve our goals. We feel great because we've actually built another little pyramid. We've done something successful. We've done something by which we might be recognized or remembered for. And we feel good about it. And then we start to feel empty again. And then we find, well, we've got to set some more goals. And so you start going around the circle again, and it's kind of like a circle of life. And what we need is somebody or someone to break into that circle of life to help us to make sense of the meaning and the purpose of life. A sense of emptiness and lack of satisfaction is all around us. I want you to listen to a letter that Charles Swindoll includes in his book, Living on the Ragged Edge. It's a very honest letter, and I suggest to you tonight that there are a number in our church family who feel like this. Here's how the letter goes. I want to make some things clear up front. I may not be very old, but I figured out a long time ago that pursuing the world's pleasure wouldn't satisfy. I know that running away is no answer either, but don't you dare think that these feelings are confined to those who choose these roads. Don't you dare think that only middle-aged, money-grubbing entrepreneurs face this crisis. I'm not yet 28 years old. I talk heart to heart with God every day. I live life within the confines of a sensitive conscience. I have a beautiful wife and daughter. But I'm empty. I've come to the conclusion that living is a waste of time. All is vanity, striving after the wind. There is not one thing on this earth to make it worth staying. I used to think that ministering to others was reason enough to live. It isn't. Neither is raising a family. Yet far be it from me to sin against God by taking my own life. I have no intention of doing anything like that. I've just realized that this life has nothing to offer. It does not mean that I am without hope. I'm gambling on eternity's being worth it. I have to take that gamble. It's my only choice. I've run out of other choices. Responsibilities make me feel like I should stay. But only the hope of God's smile makes me willing to stay. Charles, don't forget that this book, meaning Solomon's Journal, applies to growing Christians. Many of us wonder daily if it's worthwhile to go on. I wonder if you had that sense as a Christian. Is it really worthwhile to go on? I want to suggest to you that there are some in our church family who could have written that letter this evening. So how can this book of Ecclesiastes help us to make sense of life? How can it help us to fill that sense of emptiness that so many people are feeling today? Well, let's go to chapter 1 and verse 12. Let's just pick up the reading this evening. If you've got a Bible in front of you, it's helpful for me if you can follow this, because it'll help my explanation of it this evening to be a little easier. And here's Solomon speaking. He's defining himself and introducing himself in this letter. And he says, I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on me. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And here's Solomon saying to us, look, I have devoted myself to looking closely at these things. He says in verse 12, I have devoted myself, or verse 13, I have devoted myself to study and to explore. This isn't just a half-hearted look at the meaning of life. Solomon is saying, I am going to go to the root of all things. I'm going to go as far as I need to go. He's going to conduct some serious research into the root of all things. This is going to be a thorough examination of the meaning and purpose of life. He's going to leave no stone unturned. And it's incredibly practical. Solomon wants us to learn from his own mistakes. He wants us to understand the things that he's tried. He wants us to see the cul-de-sacs that he's gone down, and so that we will learn from his experience and not make the same mistakes. And he had everything at his disposal. There was nothing he could not do. There was nothing he could not try, because he was the king. This really is a story of a man of great wisdom and intellect. Let's follow some of the conclusions he reaches as we move from chapter 1 into chapter 2. There are a number of conclusions, and I'll set them out on the wall behind me so that you can follow them through. He says, I'm going to take a careful look at all things. So verses 16 to 18, he looks at the pursuit of intellectual things. He looks at a life that is disconnected from God and asks the question, can the pursuit of intellectual things bring me fulfillment? Answer, verses 16 to 18 is no. I can't. He says, I've experienced much wisdom and knowledge. But he says to him, I've learned that this too, end of verse 17, is a chasing after the wind. It's not going to work. If your life is disconnected from God, there's no point in pursuing intellectual things in a search for fulfillment. Then he moves into chapter 2 and he says, well, actually, let's try a different direction. Let's try the pursuit of laughter and pleasure. Surely that will bring me lasting satisfaction. Again, the conclusion is the same, isn't it? Chapter 2, verse 1. But that also proved to be meaningless. Verse 2 of chapter 2. Laughter, I said, it's foolish. That didn't seem to work either. Well, what about wine, women, and song? Surely that's going to spice life up a little bit. Surely that's going to give me some sense of meaning and purpose in my life. Verse 3. He says, I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. It's all pretty empty, really. Then he says, well, what about some of the great building projects that I've undertaken? He says, verse 4, I undertook some great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoir to water groves of flourishing trees. He says, what about these projects? Surely that would give me a sense of meaning and purpose in life. Surely that would give me a sense of fulfillment so I could stand back at the end of the day and say, look at what I have built. But it doesn't seem to work. Because a life that is disconnected from God will ultimately find no fulfillment in the things of this world. So he decides in verses 5 to 8 to acquire slaves and silver and gold and treasures from other kings and lands. Then in the second part of verse 8, he attempts to find fulfillment by putting together a harem of beautiful women and hundreds of wives and fine singers. And once again, I think Solomon could almost sing the words of U2. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Look at his conclusion. In verse 10, he said, I denied myself nothing that my eyes desired. He says, there were no limits on my explorations. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. One of the things that we can say about Solomon is that he was no hypocrite. He said it as it was. He says, these are the conclusions to the things that I've been looking at. He's frustrated in his search for meaning and purpose in life, but he's willing to tell us what he has learned because he wants us to learn from the mistakes of his own experience. And that brings us to a turning point. In chapter 2 and verse 12, literally he says, if you look at the Bible, you'll see he says, I turned my thoughts in a different direction. It's almost as if he's saying at this point in the book that I've been able to find lasting satisfaction in the sensual pleasures of life. And I've been unable to find lasting satisfaction in some of the big building projects that I've undertaken. He says, it just hasn't worked. It hasn't given me that sense of purpose. So he says, I decided to turn in a different direction. I decided to explore in a different avenue. And here are the results of his explorations. And in the next passage, these verses from verses 12 to 26, these are the verses I just want us to zero in on tonight. Because in these verses, Solomon embarks on three pairs of contrasts as he explores the meaning and the purpose of life. See if you can follow these with me. Firstly, in verses 13 to 16, he draws a comparison between a wise and a foolish lifestyle. It's almost like Solomon's embarking on an experiment. And he says, well, I'm the king. I can do what I want. I can choose which way I want to go. Maybe I'll pursue a wise lifestyle. I'll pursue life with my eyes open. Or maybe I could pursue a foolish lifestyle and just sort of go with the flow. So I'll just go with the crowd. It doesn't really matter. I'm the king. I can choose which way I want to go. That is the experiment. And initially in verses 13 and 14, if you look at it with me, you'll see that the conclusion to his experiment is that obviously wisdom is a much more meaningful approach to life. Verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. Verse 14, the wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in darkness. He realizes that wisdom makes the most sense. Somebody walks through life with their eyes wide open, while the foolish person doesn't take life too seriously. They kind of wander through life with their eyes half closed. But it's obvious that wisdom wins the experiment hands down. But yet, says Solomon, at the end of the day, if a life is lived in disconnection from God, actually, he says, the same fate overtakes both. The end of verse 14. He says, I came to realize that actually the same fate overtakes both the foolish and the wise. So what if I get a whole string of GCSEs? So what if I get a whole crowd of A stars in my A levels? So what if I get a university degree? So what if I get a great job? So what if I have a successful career? So what if I buy a home and raise a family? I may decide to plan wisely for my retirement. I may decide to live life with my eyes wide open. But Solomon says at the end of the day, if my life is disconnected from God, where is that going to get me? And Solomon would say to us tonight, don't waste your time on building pyramids of success and material things, because they'll soon be forgotten. That's why the pharaohs built those tombs. They wanted to be remembered. They wanted people not to forget about their lives, so that somehow or other their greatness on earth could help them find their way to heaven, so that they could be remembered forever. And Solomon says in verse 16, both the wise and the foolish will die. Just don't waste your time. To the dead end street. His conclusion in verse 17, he says, I hated life. I was disconnected from God. So all of these things, all of these building projects, all of the years of education, all the investments of time and energy, they accomplish nothing because my life is disconnected from God. And then the journey continues into verses 18 to 21. He moves from this comparison between a wise and a foolish lifestyle, and he moves here to the comparison between the present and the future. And he thinks to himself, well, if I accumulate a lot of things in this life, perhaps I will find some meaning and purpose by giving the things that I've achieved in this life to those who come after me. Maybe that will give me a sense of achievement. His attention turns to what happens to the stuff we leave behind. Look what he says in verse 18. He says, I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. Maybe if I leave my stuff to my kids, that will give me a sort of sense of satisfaction in life. Maybe that will give me some sense of meaning and purpose. Even if I don't get it out of my own life, maybe if I can give what I have earned to those who come after me, maybe that will help. And he draws this contrast between the present and the future, between working now and leaving his achievements for people who come after him. But it's not a great contrast, is it? He says, I hated my work. And you see, when we are disconnected from God in our work lives, it's pretty empty, it's pretty futile, it's pretty purposeless. What is it like when we work? We plan, we sacrifice, we travel, we worry, we skip our holidays, we work all the hours that there are in the day, and then we leave it all to somebody else. What's the point of it all? Verses 18 and 19, for someone to take control of all that I have given my life to. Verse 20, he concludes, yeah, this is meaningless. This isn't going to work. This isn't going to give me a lasting sense of purpose in my life, no matter how hard I work in this life, because I have to leave it all behind at the end of the day. Read this week of a story of a self-made man who accumulated a multi-million dollar business almost overnight. One of those companies that went public overnight. And then the very next day, for some strange reason, the man drove his red Ferrari through 20 feet of safety rail, plunged into a ravine and died. It was calculated that at his death, he was worth more than $9 million. You see, the things that we are working for in this life can sometimes seem terribly irrelevant when we face the fact, as Solomon does in this passage here, that death comes to us all sooner or later. Death's got a great way of challenging our perspective on life. And when Solomon gets to verse 21, it's almost as if he throws his hands up in the air and says, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. All that you work for goes to somebody else. It reminds me of a question that somebody asked after the death of a friend. Did they leave much to their family? Well, you know the answer to that question, don't you? They left everything. Of course they left everything. Because that's how it is. So he draws this comparison between the present and the future. He says, you know, if I leave all this stuff for somebody else, is that going to help my sense of meaning and purpose in the present? Answer, no. If my life is disconnected from God, no way. And the third comparison that he draws comes in verses 22 and 23. It's the comparison between a day's work and what I've described here as an evening off. Some of you know what that feels like, don't you? You get home at the end of a busy day and you kick your shoes off and you crash out for the evening. And the day has been so busy and it's been an intensely pressurized day. And you kick your shoes off in the evening and you crash out and you think to yourself, surely that will bring me some sense of satisfaction. The challenge is just to rest from the day. I've done a good day's work. I provided for myself. I provided for my family. And so I'm going to ask the very important question in verse 22. He says, what does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? And here's his observation. For a life that is lived out of a relationship with God, he says, all his days, his work, his pain and grief, even at night, his mind does not rest. Some of you know what that feels like, don't you? You get home from work. The day has been stressful. And it seems no matter how hard you try, you cannot switch off after a hard day's work. And instead of leaving work at home, you've actually brought it home with you. And your mind cannot rest. And when we work and we live like that, it all seems so pointless. So Solomon's saying, it's a meaningless way of life. And so we're back to the full circle that we began with. This kind of circle of life that we can feel sometimes so trapped by. We set our goals, we achieve our goals, we feel great. And then it starts to feel so empty again. And so we set a few more goals and we go around the circle another time. And Solomon is describing for us here a description of life without God. And if you're not in relationship with God, it really doesn't matter if you pursue a foolish or a wise lifestyle. Because it's never going to make sense to you. Because all of us will die at the end of the day. If you're not living a life in relationship with God, then it doesn't matter how hard you work in this life and how much you leave for people who come behind you, it will not give you a sense of meaning and purpose in life. It doesn't matter how hard you work and how much you try to switch off in the evening time, it's not going to work. This is a very up-to-date commentary on life without God in the world in which we live today. As you look at that circle on the screen behind me, we need someone, don't we, who will break into that circle of life. We need something or someone who will explode it apart and show us a different way of living and a different way of thinking. And I'm so glad that we've got a verse 24 in this passage, because that's where the light begins to shine. It's quite dark stuff, actually, isn't it, until you get to this passage, until you get to this verse. And as Solomon comes to verse 24, it's almost as if a little ray of hope begins to shine into his thinking and his experiments. And he begins to recognize that God actually has revealed some important things to him. And here are three things I want you to realize. The verse 24, without God, there can be no lasting satisfaction. That's what Solomon is saying in verse 24. He says, look, you know, unless we have a relationship with God, he says, you can do nothing better than to eat and to drink and to find satisfaction in what you do. That's all you're left to. And he makes it very clear that this is something that God has revealed to him. He's saying, without God, the best that you can do with your life is to have a good time and try and get by as best you can. And Solomon likens that kind of thinking to a meaninglessness, to a chasing after the wind, kind of reaching out and trying to grasp something that you cannot get hold of. And Solomon is saying to us, you need to learn from my experience. Don't make the same mistakes that I made. These areas of wisdom and entertainment and employment can be meaningful, they can be enjoyable. But when those things become the kind of things that we live for, the kind of things that get us out of bed in the morning, when we begin to elevate those things over our relationship with God, they become, as Johnny was explaining last Sunday, like they become idols that we start to worship. And we need to recognize, because in many ways, this is the theme tune of this book. We will hear this tune being played over and over again, that without God, there can be no lasting satisfaction. It doesn't matter what avenue you go down. Whatever route we may try in our search for satisfaction, the Bible tells us that there is only one way to God. Jesus put it like this. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. In other words, as we were saying last night at Ivan and Margaret's farewell, we're not saved by a principle. We're saved by the person of Jesus Christ. Only by faith in him. As we were singing in some of the songs which Jenna chose this evening, will we discover the fullness of life that he offers to each one of us. So that's the first thing that Solomon discovers in verse 24, that without God, there can be no lasting satisfaction. If your life is disconnected from God this evening, it doesn't matter what avenue of life you go down to look for fulfillment and satisfaction, it will not work. It will not last. Solomon wants us to understand that without a relationship with God, there can be no lasting satisfaction. Second thing that he discovers is a very important principle that we find in God's word. All good things are gifts from God to be enjoyed. Solomon's mentioned so many things in this passage, doesn't he? He's explored so many different avenues: pleasure, laughter, food, drink, imagination, employment and work, projects, wisdom, loving relationships. Just some of the good things that he's explored. But you see, what happens in this life is that we so often take those good things that God gives to us and then we push him to the margin of our lives. And then we wonder why we have this emptiness, this sense of purposelessness. And we discover, as Solomon has found, that things will not satisfy us. Listen to the words of a man describing his life without God. I've had few difficulties in life. Many friends and great successes. I've gone from wife to wife, from house to house. I've visited great countries. But I am fed up. I am fed up with devices to fill up 24 hours of each day. That's pretty empty, isn't it? I am fed up with devices to fill up 24 hours of each day. And Solomon points us to the answer, verse 25. He says, without God, who can eat and who can find enjoyment? The man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and happiness. It is only God that can give us that lasting sense of satisfaction. And we need to recognize that God has given us some great gifts to enjoy. And Solomon has listed so many of them in this passage as he makes his various explorations. And many of these things are good in and of themselves. But when we begin to elevate them above our relationship with God, then everything gets out of kilter. True pleasure only comes when we acknowledge and revere God, which is how this book concludes in chapter 12 and verse 13. But we won't spoil the ending because it'll be a few weeks before we get there. And thirdly, this curious little verse in verse 26. And I think the lesson from this final verse in this chapter is that we must not presume on God's goodness and grace. I struggle to try and understand what this verse meant. Maybe you can have a go at it this evening and let me know before you leave. But this is what I think it means. That it's God who directs and rewards our lives, but the manner in which God chooses to do that is known to God rather than us. It's a curious verse, isn't it? Verse 26, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and happiness, but to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So let me ask you the question that we began with. What are you building for? Because that's the question that the book of Ecclesiastes asks us. What are you building your life on? What are the foundations of your life? What are you living for? The question that I was asking them in Balamida this morning came from a very different part of God's word, but it was the same question. Are we building for our own kingdom or are we building for the kingdom of God? That, I think, is one of the questions that lies behind the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. And Jesus made it very clear, didn't he? He's teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. He put it like this. He says, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Don't embark on that pagan lifestyle. He will not satisfy you. Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth. This is kingdom living. These are the values of the kingdom of God. This is what gives us a sense of meaning and purpose as God's people. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. And here's a really important verse, isn't it? Because it really powers home the message tonight and the challenge of this passage. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So I guess the question we ask ourselves as we come to the end of this passage and as we come to communion is, where's my heart? What kind of pyramids am I building?